Welcome, dear listeners, once again to Food Conversations, Season 9. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Sukwepemc Kulu, the ancestral stolen and unceded lands of the Sukwepemc people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, when your father's a judge, and your mother is a dietitian, it could be construed as no accident that the career your life follows would have something to do with legal enactments and food. We cannot live without food, and every society and community needs rules to guide its functioning. Our world is currently beset by startling planetary changes and tumultuous social unrest, as well as widespread inequality. In that context, ensuring that every human has enough food to eat, accompanied by serious attempts to mitigate and adapt to the many forms of planetary disruption in place, is an existential priority. My guest today on Food Conversations is Kerry Fowler, who has been working almost all of his life on ensuring food security for all of us and has been rewarded repeatedly and deservedly for that work. The most signal honor he has received recently in this regard is the World Food Prize, which was given to him in 2024 for his work on seed genetics and especially for his role in establishing the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. At present, his official title, recently taken away by the current U.S. administration, is Special Envoy for Global Food Security with the United States Department of State. Kerry, it's terrific to have you on the show today. Thank you for joining us.
Sure, thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's wonderful. The theme of Food Conversations is food sovereignty and food security. And to have somebody like yourself who's been immersed in this broad field for decades is really an opportunity for many people to learn more about the larger situation, the larger context in which we find ourselves placed today. Perhaps we could start with you sharing something about the recent action by the World Food Prize Foundation, putting forth a call for what they're calling a moonshot to end global hunger. Maybe you could describe what the word moonshot in this context is meant to imply.
Sure. Well, this is really something near and dear to my heart. This initiative originated out of my office at the State Department in the fall. And moonshot really refers back to the early 1960s and John Kennedy, when Kennedy said that within a decade, he wanted to put a man on the moon and bring him back safely. And people started referring to that as a moonshot. I would just mention that, of course, there were people in those days saying that was crazy, it was impossible, couldn't be done. And yet it was done. And I think that that's the spirit in which we're acting now. We have some big challenges ahead of us, in certainly in terms of meeting food demand and food need in 2050. And the way things are going, I'm sorry to say, it's going to take a moonshot for us to deliver.
We're up against it, and we're up against obstacles we have as a species created primarily for ourselves. We have done this. What is part of this moonshot concept is reference to the work of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in Brazil, who has really reversed some of the unfortunate policies of his predecessor and done some really, really profoundly valuable things with respect to food security. Maybe you could just outline what you see as the reason for that being a focal point for this new initiative.
Well, I think you have to start with the current situation. And I think it's fair to say that our current problems, or let's go back to saying that meeting food demand and need by 2050 is not going to be done through business as usual. Indeed. And as I look at the trends, I would say it's not going to be done even by business as unusual or improved business as usual. It's going to take something, much more dramatic than that. And the, you know, the sad fact is that we start with a world in which 700 to 800 million people are food insecure. Probably 300 million really don't know where their next meal is going to come from. We have healthy diets being unaffordable to 3 billion people on Earth. The low-income people on Earth, you know, can't afford a safe and nutritious diet. They would have to spend twice as much as they do already on food, and that's simply a mathematical impossibility. And, you know, in 2023, 58% of the people in Africa at some point in the year suffered from moderate to severe food insecurity. Yes. That's the world we're living in right now.
Indeed.
So, and of course, the causes of that are many. It's not simply inadequate food production, for example. There are policy issues in spades involved in that. But looking forward, if we're going to see possibly even declines in food production in the midst of a rising human population, particularly in Africa, then obviously we're not going to have food security. And, you know, with that comes just a mountain of trouble. We know that conflict and food insecurity go hand in hand. I think it was a former Secretary General of the UN that said, if you don't feed people, you feed conflict.
Indeed.
So there are many ramifications for not solving this problem, and it behooves us to think outside of the box at this point.
Yeah, the notion of food security or war, I think there's a title of a book recently that was something along those lines. And it's interesting that the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has only recently started to address the issue of conflict as a source of ecological disruption, which is a kind of an astonishing hiatus. And yet it was a political decision that led to that, primarily, unfortunately, by the U.S., didn't, and other countries as well in Europe, didn't want reporting of how much money they were spending on guns and tanks and stuff like that and bombs, because it has an enormous impact on climate. And now we're recognizing that almost peace and war and food and war and climate, addressing climate issues and war are at the antipodes of one another. They are far, far apart. Now, one of the things that Lula da Silva did was he launched the Global Alliance Against Hunger and Poverty, and set up a task force. And it's just a little while ago had its second meeting. It's going to have another meeting in the summer. What role will this institution play, and who's involved besides the government of Brazil?
Well, the government of Brazil is leading the G20 this year. So when I was working at the State Department, I worked under the presidencies of a couple of different countries, most notably Japan and Italy, both of whom prioritized food security in the G7 meetings. And we had representatives of the G20, specifically Brazil, coming to our meetings as observers, which was very interesting. I think it's the first time that's happened. And what happened there was the hope was that there would be a transition from the kind of discussions we were having in the G7 to the G20. Mm-hmm. I think that certainly the hope of members of the G7, at least while I was representing the U.S. in the G7 meetings on food security, was that some of the initiatives that we were discussing and promoting in the G7 would carry forth and be expanded in the G20. And some of those were really, you know, interesting things. We very much, for example, last year, were prioritizing work on indigenous crops in Africa to improve productivity and value chains of those crops and to get them into the food systems and get them into school lunch programs, for instance. Because one of the things, by the way, is that about our current situation that I find most tragic is that there are 60 million children in the world today under the age of five who are stunted. And that means cognitively and physically stunted and will be for the rest of their lives because of malnutrition. And that's particularly an issue with macro and micronutrients that can be solved by can't be solved by simply a greater intake of some of the staple crops. It's not about filling your belly. It's about having a good, balanced, nutritious diet.
And the other side of that coin, and it comes up repeatedly in description of this call to action, it's intimately tied up to economic issues and food distribution. In other words, non-agrarian factors play an enormously important role. I had a conversation recently with Valerie Tarasuk at the University of Toronto, who's part of the PROOF program there. You may have heard of her. People sometimes hear of Canadian activities south of the border. But she pointed out that with the Canada Old Age Pension, the Canada Pension Plan, food insecurity drops by 50% when an elderly person starts to receive the old age pension or the Canada Pension. And this intimate bond between material sufficiency, not excess, but just simple material sufficiency in terms of purchasing power or at least basic funds to look after yourself, is often neglected. You know, it's not just getting, people often say that there's enough food in the world if we distributed it properly, but we don't distribute it properly. And the imbalance in distribution arises from these economic factors, which are strongly referred to in terms of things like paying tribute to President Lula's achievement in first administration, which saw poverty reduced by half, social welfare reforms, anti-hunger programs, and economic growth. In other words, you can't separate these issues readily. They're so intimately bound up.
Yeah, that's right. I'm glad that you mentioned, actually, people saying to you, to me, to everybody else, that the world produces enough food if only we distributed it properly. Frankly, I get tired of hearing that. Mm. And the reason is I think it's a cop-out. Okay. I think people who say that sort of wave their hand and say, well, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. Oh. That's just the way it is. And I think as a strategy for action, it's very poor. And as an analysis of the problem, it's also poor because, frankly, we live in a world with different kinds of agricultural systems. And the world producing enough food in aggregate doesn't really solve the problem. The problem is, do you produce it close enough to home, and do you have access to that?
Sure.
And that's the real issue.
Yes, and I think what follows from that, and it's actually part of the text of the original letter, it says the signatories to this call from the World Food Prize Foundation recognizes or warns that in the 21st century, it is primarily the lack of political will and leadership allow hunger and malnutrition to persist and to rise. In other words, it's a decision-making process that is not complicated if people apply their minds to it, but they have to do that. They have to apply their minds to saying it's a serious issue.
Well, I look back at my own history in this field. It goes back, sorry to say now, about 50 years. And I think for the first time in my life, I've come to have the feeling that we really could solve this problem. I would say 30 years ago, even though I might not have given voice to being pessimistic, I was. But now I think we actually know how to solve this problem. It's within our grasp. So it's a complicated issue, and there are many different elements, but we have a pretty good handle on most of them. Mm. Obviously the political will is not there. And that's very evident. Let's face it. The countries of the world adapted the Sustainable Development Goals, the second goal of which is we would eliminate world hunger by the year 2030. No way. It's not happening. In fact, you know, the 700 or 800 million people who are food insecure today, we're going to have a larger number in 2030 and an even larger number in 2050, unless we take some fairly dramatic steps.
I think you've pinpointed the fact that the obstacles to these achieving these goals are purely human, the decision-making process within the human community. Because, as you said earlier, just saying the food isn't distributed properly is kind of like going to an indigenous community in northern Canada, or even in the continental United States, and saying, you know, there's a high rate of disease and poverty among indigenous people. Well, bully for you for recognizing that someone who makes that pronouncement. Yeah. The issue is, how do you make that not happen? Because it shouldn't happen. It is unconscionable that it's happening.
I think that there, you know, there's some physical constraints too. It's not like we live in a world of unlimited natural resources. And when you look at agriculture, I think one of the things that spurred us to pull together this group of Nobel scientists, Nobel laureates and World Food Prize laureates, was that the projections for crop productivity were negative towards 2050, when they ought to be astonishingly positive. But some of those projections don't take into account some of the physical limitations that we're going to face. Soil degradation and soil loss and expansion of cities onto good land, water constraints, things like that. And those are really difficult problems. They can't, they're not matters that can just easily or quickly be solved by new policies. But new policies are necessary as part of the route towards a solution of those problems.
Yeah, a policy is really just it's a concrete evocation of some fundamental principle that applies to everybody in a community. So you simply enunciate it, and then you use it as a guideline for action. A couple of things that I was struck by as part of this call by the World Food Prize Foundation. One was, it talks about building resistance and investing in smallholder farmers, which ties back to your participation, we'll say several years ago in 1978, the publication Food First, Beyond the Myth of Food of Scarcity, which you co-authored with Francis Moore-Lappe, of course, and Joseph Collins, the well-known authors of Diet for a Small Planet. And its sequel, saying you don't need to balance your food as carefully as they said in the first book. And First, of course, is the organization they founded. But the essence of much of what they're saying and much of the research they've done around the world with Food First is to show that smallholders are the backbone, are the essential ingredient in food, transforming the food system. Could you maybe talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I'm particularly focused, and was when I was at the State Department, particularly focused on Africa. That's where the greatest food insecurity problem exists, and with rising population there, that's where it's going to be particularly acute in the future. Africa is a continent of small farmers, and it's particularly, I would say, a continent of small farmers who are also women. Mm-hmm. We neglect, overlook the history of agriculture and don't realize that women are the gender that domesticated most of our domesticated crops.
Absolutely. And it's a wonderful thing that we have managed to expunge that signal fact from human records. It's amazing that we've been able to get away with it.
I guess that would be too woke to mention it, but that's the case. And women have been tending these crops for millennia. What we did at the State Department was to promote something called the Vision for Adapted Crops and Soils. And I don't know if you intended to talk about it in this broadcast, but we went through quite a process to identify, working mostly with African researchers, and to identify the African indigenous crops that had the most potential for adding nutrition to the diet in Africa. Why indigenous crops? Well, a couple of reasons. The scientific reason is they're highly nutritious, and nutrition is what needs to be added to the diets in Africa. But the thing that really drove me emotionally was they are mostly tended by women. And it just, and the fact that they haven't been prioritized in the past by plant breeders or researchers or whomever has nothing to do with what people sometimes said to me, which was, oh, Carrie, those are minor crops because they don't taste good. Well, give me a break. I live on a farm in upstate New York, and I grow as many of those crops as can be grown in a farm in upstate New York, because I wanted to see for myself. And I challenge anyone to come to dinner and tell me that what we're cooking tastes bad, because actually some of these crops are really delicious. Yes. And but of course they haven't seen that bump in productivity that we've seen in some of our major staple crops after investing billions of dollars into research on them. Comparatively speaking, they don't compete in the marketplace, and they don't because of politics and history and investment. But the thing that,
I'm sighing as you speak, just so you know, it's taken us so long.
Well, the thing that drove me most emotionally to engage in that work was that it simply occurred to me that empowering the crops that women grow is a way of empowering women.
Yes.
And that was desperately needed as well. So we could do two things at once.
You may have heard of Suzanne Simard. She's the researcher, forester, who characterized and proved the communication between conifers and deciduous trees through underground fungal networks. Mm. And I'm sure you've heard about that, because it's become a well-accepted theme in forest dynamics, but also in plant dynamics in general. And she was invited to a conference of shamans in the Amazon basin, because they were saying to her, your research is proving what we've known for a very long time, which is that the interrelationship between plants is profound and really important. And they said three things. The first thing they said was that the leaders are a little bit lost. Most of the changes are taking place at a grassroots level. And I'll get you to comment on that in a moment. And I have a pretty good idea what you're going to say. They also said, though, that women are leading the transformational changes that are needed. And I think you've touched on that now. And it's come up as a theme on Food Conversations repeatedly because, first of all, many of the guests are women, and they are very articulate and very clear, and they have an unassailable vision of what's coming forward and what needs to be done. But the other thing they said, which is also germane to what you said a moment ago, and that is that they feel we're going to make it. We're going to achieve the necessary goals. It won't be easy. It's going to be a lot of hard work. But the shape of the future is starting to be delineated, the shape of what we need to do, the naming of the things we need to describe as phenomena that will change things is starting to happen. And it's, again, becoming repeated and strengthened and reinforced. So why don't you talk about that notion that grassroots changes? I mean, what you're describing in Africa applies just as much to any other part of the world, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. You ask, can we talk about it? Darn right, we can talk about it, because it's central to the transformational change that are taking place. So why don't you talk about how that process is working in Africa, so we can see the connections with what's going on in the rest of the world?
I think, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, what we have tried to catalyze, and by the way, this work that we did at the State Department was done in co-sponsorship with the African Union and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, and very much with local organizations in Africa, including most notably the African Plant Breeders Association, which 10 years ago didn't exist. I think that we couldn't have conceived of this type of approach 20, 30 years ago, in part because, honestly, the capacity to do this work in Africa just didn't exist at the scale that would be needed to make any kind of real change. But now there have been more than 150 plant breeders in Africa, educated up to the PhD level, working on these indigenous crops.
Yes.
That was inconceivable years ago. And almost half of them are women. And the percentage that are women is rising every year. And they're all embedded, all of them, 100% embedded in national programs, not in companies or
yes.
NGOs, but in national programs.
Public service.
Where, yeah. And so I think the capacity there exists, and the African Orphan Crops Consortium and the African Plant Breeders Association are putting those groups together. So you might have one or two plant breeders of one crop in a particular country, and a couple of plant breeders in the same crop in another country. And those can be sort of cohorts with each other and collaborators. And so we're finally getting that type of human and technical capacity to do the work. And when that happens, you can dream bigger dreams.
And women have a capacity, which is, I don't know if it's genetic or socialized, but it's certainly a role they play, which is the role of collaborator. The male of the species, of which you and I are both examples, tends to compete and to devolve into conflict relatively readily. Women just don't do that so much. They compete in a more amiable fashion and are supportive of one another. And it seems to me those are qualities that really exemplify some of the changes that need to take place. You said, is Africa something worth talking about when we're here in North America? Well, of course it is, because the same human issues arise on every continent and in every culture. We just have to recognize that we are sort of one species and start collaborating and trading. That's interesting. Archaeological findings have shown that our ancestors did a heck of a lot more. The Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnons, which we consider Homo sapiens, actually shared technology. There's new evidence from some archaeological research of all places, a very conflicted area, the Middle East, showing that the same projectile points were being created by Neanderthals and a short distance away Homo sapiens. We have this idea that we've got to overcome the other, but actually we have to work closely with the other all the time. Now, that's
well,
comment on, I hope.
as you were talking about the differences in gender, it reminded me of what we say down south where I come from Tennessee. Well, bless our hearts, you know. Sometimes
yeah.
not a compliment.
I was talking to some guests about 4-H, the 4-H world, and the 4-H's, I didn't know what they stood for, but the second one is heart. Head, you know, to think clearly, and heart to engage in more commitment. And it seems to me that that's a big feature of what we're talking about now, that we activate our hearts, which say, don't treat other people as separate, treat them as like us and needing the things that we all need. Now, some of the other things that this call to, call for change from the World Food Prize Foundation, one other thing that I think is worth talking about is a recommendation to reform the multilateral financial system and the unsustainable debt of low-income countries.
Yeah.
That's something that the IMF and the World Bank have been kind of focused on for a long time, the Bretton Woods agreements, but it's coming to fruition that we realize there's some big mistakes, some big correctives that need to be implemented in that area.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's tempting for me to say that's above my pay grade, and it certainly is, but I certainly saw that in the work that I was doing at the State Department, the kinds of constraints that countries had. I worked pretty intensely with some African countries, but also Central America and some in Asia. And they just didn't have the kind of discretionary funds in their national budgets to be able to do this work. And bear in mind that agricultural research kind of gets by default a bad name with the general public. It has this feeling of, you know, folks running around with white lab coats, just spending inordinate amounts of money just to satisfy their curiosity about some inane and totally irrelevant topic. But in fact, agricultural research is one of the best investments that any government can make. It's one of the few investments, actually, that more than pays for itself. So, for instance, I was on a board overseeing the U.S. foreign aid program during the Obama administration, and we commissioned a report, which was actually published under the Trump administration, about the impact of agricultural research, and focusing, by the way, on agricultural research that the U.S. government did that was aimed towards improving agriculture in developing countries. And the question was, well, what's in it for us? What's in it for American farmers? And the results of that study was we get a better than 10 to 1 return on investment for American farmers of the research that we do for other farmers. So name another government program that has that kind of payoff. And so when countries are in economic straits and can't afford to do that research, or if you're in Africa and you have a country that can't afford the researchers to adapt that type of research to the local conditions, that's really a losing proposition. You've really shot yourself in the foot.
Yeah, there's so much involved in what we're talking about that is essentially global in application and implication. Mm-hmm. No way to get away from that fact. The idea that what occurs in one ecosystem or one bioclimatic region is somehow unrelated. I live in a province that's mostly mountainous, and it's a province of microclimates. And you hear people talking about what you do when you go from one microclimate to another. You can't just take your seeds along with you and just throw them in the ground and expect much to happen, because maybe the rainfall is 30% higher on this side of the hill than it is on the other side of the hill. You're in a rain shadow on the other side.
Yeah. So there's, I used to live on the top of Burnaby Mountain and used to get the weather reports from sunny Tawasin. And
indeed, I know, as you were sitting in a rain cloud.
Yes, it was raining 40 days or more in concession.
Of which, what was it that drew you to Simon Fraser? Here you are from Tennessee. You're an American citizen. Often Canadian citizens go to American universities. Some Americans come to Canadian universities. We have a couple of graduates lead programs in British Columbia. What brought you to Simon Fraser?
I think it was a case of wanderlust, and I started my university time in Memphis, Tennessee, but I had a professor there that always said, you know, you should leave, and I was very involved as a young person in the civil rights movement, and as you and your listeners will know, I think Martin Luther King was assassinated in my hometown, and I was actually at his last speech the night before he was assassinated. It was a traumatic time, and I just really needed to see something of the rest of the world. And in those days, pre-internet and such, going to the West Coast, going to another country to the north, that was as far as my imagination could take me.
Still another country to the north.
Yes, still another country to the north.
I said at the beginning of the program that with a father as a judge and a mother as a dietitian, and that was a little bit presumptuous of me, but what can you identify as you look back that had shaped, first of all, this profound interest in civil liberties and social justice, but also, you know, eventually drifted into food? Can you see roots there? I mean, everybody's got them, and I can't imagine that this didn't play into your choice of future activities.
No, I think you were right in your introduction. It had to do with my mother and my father, with growing up in some fairly tumultuous times. If you were growing up as someone who was sensitive and dare I say progressive in those days, you were alone. So
talking to somebody in Canada, you can say progressive.
Yes, it was a crucible at that moment. I think the other big influence was my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who operated the family farm. Oh, and I spent summers with her, and she always, during her lifetime, would frequently ask me, don't you want to be a farmer? And I never gave the correct answer as she saw it. But I realized that in my family, there was great reverence for farmers, and that part of my family was involved with public service, and part of my family was involved with farming. And both sides of my family considered farming to be public service.
Which it is, which, I mean,
it is.
They're right. We can force your family's position retroactively.
So I didn't grow up looking down on farmers. I grew up really admiring them and realizing what an incredibly tough life they had. I can recall sitting on the front porch of the family farmhouse, and in those days, one of the crops that we grew was cotton, and there was an insect that attacked cotton called the boll weevil. Made a tiny little prick of a hole in the boll of the cotton, and when that happened, the boll was going to fall off before it turned to cotton. And you sat there not knowing what your income was going to be for the year, because your entire income was out in the field, and there was no social safety net. And that's not an easy life. And farmers have to make decisions every day upon which their entire livelihood depends. And that's one of the reasons why I think it behooves us to be sensitive to that, to honor them, and not to not to be stingy when it comes to doing the kind of research that can help farmers have more security and be more productive.
And that ties so directly to the notion of social justice, whether you call it food justice or you call it social justice. And in fact, your degrees were in sociology. So you put that on full frontal, the notion that society's constructs and the kind of patterns and beliefs and or illusions that people hold about the reality of the world they live in shapes their actions and their understanding and their behavior. But social justice seems to me, you know, civil liberties is one part of it, but social justice in general is so embedded in the notion of food security and food sovereignty. It's unfair to deny food to anybody or just to fail to make sure that they have the food they need.
Well, the other influence in my life, or I guess the eureka moment for me, was just out of university, working for the Institute for Southern Studies in the United States. It was founded by a group of white and black civil rights workers. And the idea, we published a journal called Southern Exposure. The idea was to celebrate the good things about Southern culture and to expose and fight against the bad things. We did an issue called Our Promised Land, which was about farms and agriculture in the South. And I kept complaining to the other people on the staff about how we didn't have an article about what was happening to family farms, which I could see all around me, and I knew what was happening in my grandmother's farm. And finally, they got fed up with me complaining about that and almost in unison pointed to me and said, "You write it." which I did. And it was at that moment, I guess, in the struggle to to put my thoughts together and to write such an article that I realized just that, that agriculture is a social justice subject.
Indeed, indeed, centrally so. Well, you were involved with sharecropper organizations as well.
That's
part of what you're doing. And the whole story of sharecroppers, you can't even use the word without thinking of social justice. It's kind of the pivotal aspect of what sharecroppers' lives were and or were not. They were quite dramatically.
Indeed.
Now, we have to talk about Svalbard.
Okay.
I have to talk about Svalbard. It's just, there's nothing to be done about it. Why don't you talk about the genesis of the Svalbard food seed repository? What happened that made, first of all, this little island off the coast of Norway become such a feature of 21st century humanization, 20th and 21st century?
Yeah. The background for that is that almost every nation in the world, a few exceptions such as the Holy See, have a seed bank. Mm-hmm. And they have a seed bank to conserve diversity, typically of the crops that are grown in their country. But they preserve that diversity for use. And it's not just a museum for seed diversity. It's a living facility that's meant to supply those seeds to researchers, biological researchers, and also plant breeders. But the problem there is that all of those facilities are located in the world that we know, and they're in buildings, and buildings are vulnerable to everything that we know about conflicts and electrical outages and floods and tornadoes and
yes.
Everything else, and budget cuts, and also stupid human mistakes, of which there are many.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
Because it happens a lot.
It does. It's reality. And but the problem there was that every time one of those incidents took place, we experienced an extinction event where some variety or maybe some trait encompassed in the genes in that seed became extinct. And given the kind of challenges we as a species were facing, particularly with climate change, having traits taken off the table and not be usable in the future just seemed like an incredibly stupid and short-sighted thing to do. So the question was, well, could we have a safety duplicate, a backup for those existing seed collections? And if so, where to put it? We went pretty far north to achieve that. And there were reasons for that. The Nordic countries had a safety duplicate of their collections in a shaft of an abandoned coal mine there. But the other reason was Svalbard is very, very remote. If you go to a map of the world and you put your finger on the northernmost part of mainland Norway, well, just keep going over the water and you'll find Svalbard just before you get to the North Pole. So it's very cold. And if you want to conserve seed for the long term, you freeze it. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to have a facility that would be naturally frozen without any mechanical means, which could, you know, go wrong. And Norway is and was a trusted country. So people had other countries had less reticence about sending a duplicate copy of their seeds to Norway than they would have to my country or yours even. And Norway is one of those countries that thinks long-term, acts rationally, and acts very often in the greater social good. And so Norway,
famous Nordic countries with
yes.
set examples in terms of governance and social development that many other countries are envious of. They know that if they were to raise taxes to the level that they occur in some of the Nordic countries, and of course you went to Sweden and got mm-hmm. there, so you know all about it. But it's in terms of countries that are nice to live in. Denmark is a little bit south of the Nordic countries, but it's got the same kind of overall mentality. There is a certain kind of stability and forward-looking character to those countries that I think is widely respected around the world. So it's a good choice, it seems to me, and to most people.
And Norway was generous enough to say that they would pay for it. So we did. I headed a committee that assessed the feasibility of establishing such a facility, and the Norwegians said yes to building it. And then we worked with the architects and others, and then the real nitty-gritty started of contacting all the different seed banks around the world and telling them what was happening and asking them to send their duplicate copies up there. But I should quickly say that the facility runs like a safety deposit box at your local bank. So Norway may own the mountain, but the seed deposits are owned by the depositor. And Norway doesn't go into any of those boxes, and it doesn't distribute the contents to anybody else other than the depositor. And that got us around all the issues about intellectual property rights and who owns and who controls the seed. So it's a really a free service to the seed banks around the world.
It's interesting you mentioned intellectual property rights and patents, because when it comes to obstructing sharing and wide distribution, there has been a period of time when the major large agricultural corporate players have been very jealous of intellectual property rights and use them as weapons, if you like. Something that we were talked earlier about how women solve problems, women tend to be less focused on that kind of, it's mine, you can't have it. It's more like it's mine and it could probably help you. Don't take it all, but take as much as you need. Is that a trend that you see increasing as time goes by? This awareness of and respect for collaborative, respectful global interactions?
I'm not sure which way the wind is blowing on this one at this point, to be honest. I think the work that we are doing still with the African indigenous crops, for example, may be a good test case because most of those crops are not of any great economic interest, and yet no country has the type of the amount of genetic diversity in those crops that would fuel an effective plant breeding program. So, for example, we're going to see if on the African continent, countries are willing to share and collaborate and cooperate. If they don't, they'll all suffer. If they do, I think we'll make some headway. But that's just a microcosm of some of the larger issues. I do see some of the big international research centers of of a group called the CGIAR. Have some of the biggest, best, and most used seed banks in the world, and they are sharing very routinely. I think that some countries that have large collections are not sharing routinely, and I suppose they think they're sitting on some kind of genetic gold mine, and maybe we'll make a business out of it down the road. But that hasn't happened yet. And in my career, they've been talking about it for almost 50 years and hasn't happened. So I
And
hope we can head in the other direction.
that kind of sequestration of material for narrow financial gain seems to me one of the bugbears of human development, that we have this unfortunate tendency, which interestingly, our indigenous counterparts all around the world have taught us or would have taught us to move away from. But we were inclined to dismiss, not just in North America, but on every continent, dismiss indigenous teachers as inferior or primitive or ignorant or a lot of other negative epithets. Now we're starting to discover that the principles that operated in their societies, because they were so close to natural processes, were far more successful. They managed ecosystems, but they didn't destroy them in the process of managing. You know, they're extending the prairies, the prairie grassland, by burning off forest in the south, in the mid-eastern part of the North American continent, was quite well developed, but it didn't destroy things. It just altered them to make them more productive without damaging them beyond repair.
Well, you know, I think of this genetic diversity that we have, and by the way, in Svalbard, in the sea fault, there are now 1,345,000 different samples, which is quite extraordinary. So more than 150,000 different kinds of rice. That's and same number for wheat. It's quite amazing. I used to do a little bit of an arithmetic experiment with people to discern their politics. I'll play it on you.
All right, fire away.
So let's pretend you're a seed bank, and you give 5 samples to another country, and that country gives you 4 samples. Now, you've just done some arithmetic in your mind. Did you subtract or did you add? And I think the conservative view, the let's keep this for ourselves view, was that, wait a minute, I gave you 5 samples, but I only got back 4, so I'm down 1, minus 1. Whereas my view is, no, you still have your 5 samples. Now you have 4 that you never yes. had before.
I was going to say it, Carrie. I was going to add them up and say, we got 9.
You have 9 now.
Samples. And there's more to come, because they're going to be modified by geoclimatic conditions in their own, where they're being grown, and they'll be changed, and different gene expressions will take place, and proteomics will rule, and we'll have wonderful diversity. So I'm sorry, I would have failed for being a curmudgeon on this issue.
You get a gold star for arithmetic and politics.
I hope so. Look, you wrote a book with Pat Mooney, who's a Canadian, and a real... a really stellar advocate, articulate. He's hammered away at some of the Canadian government's policies around food repeatedly, and had some impact on what's being done in this country. And the title of the book was pretty compelling. It's Shattering Food, Politics, and the Loss of Genetic Diversity. And it seems that it's around the theme of what we've been talking about how you encourage genetic diversity by being good planetary citizens, by saying don't be dog in a manger-ish, don't cling to your little corner of the planet or your planet's resources. Share it, let it grow, let it multiply.
Well, I remember in the drafting of that book, I spent weeks, maybe months, trying to think of how to open that book. What's the first sentence? And I think I can quote it for you. For all our technological wizardry, we human beings still rely on a handful of crops, a couple of inches of topsoil, and an occasional thunderstorm.
Great opening line.
And I don't, you know, I went on to say that I don't think our ancient ancestors were so cavalier about their origins. The point of it all was, we need to be a bit humble, don't we? We are still, I think there was an American conservationist named Aldo Leopold, and I believe he's credited with saying that the first rule of successful tinkering is to save all the pieces. I think when it comes to agriculture and when it comes to seed banks, we are tinkerers. We're still in the infancy of agriculture. Hunting and gathering days sustained our species for many, many more years than agriculture has. We're not gods, and we need to be humble, and we need to work together.
Humility, what a novel concept. You're married to Amy Goldman,
yes.
And she is I can only imagine the supper conversations as you're discussing the day and what grew in the orchard and what your kids are doing. But it seems to me that there would be a lot of congruence to start off with, basically, in your the way you look at things and the way you see the world. And what for you has being connected to a person with such shared, I would say, values. I mean, that's what really makes relationships work. It's not, interest in the same, sports or, sex or, eating Wheaties or something like that. It really it results from aligning values that you feel you're on the same page. How does that facilitate the work that you do, having this kind of connection to somebody who obviously is very important in your life, who understands you in a significant way?
I was drawn to Amy first by her integrity, and we served on a board together. I more or less in absentia because I was on another continent, but we went through a hard time on the board in terms of some real crises in the organization, and I saw her act with real courage and integrity, and that I think I got to know her from that. But yes, we share a lot in common. I typically, would have to say that I'm the one that is coming off with big, wild, and crazy ideas up in the clouds, and she's the one that actually knows how to grow this stuff.
She brings you down to
She she's working on a book on peppers right now, by the way, and has been working on it for 12 years. And she said to me the other day that she thought she could whittle down this book on peppers to include maybe as few as 200 different varieties, for which she'll have photographs and agronomic notes and taste tests and all kinds of things, and the history of where the variety came from. I said, "Well, Amy, that's great, but I think your reader would like to know if those are your top 200 varieties. Well, how many did you have to reject to get to that 200?" And she said, "Oh, that's a good idea. I'll count them." Well, in the last 12 years, she's grown more than 2,500 different varieties of peppers.
Oh, this is Amy's greatest hits.
Yes. And she has books on melons. I think that's her most beautiful and interesting book. Tomatoes, squashes, and pumpkins. So we do try to practice what we preach. And I manage the apple orchard, by the way. I don't know if you're in an apple area of BC. I know there are such areas.
Oh,
So I have a little apple orchard and I play around as a pure hobbyist, in addition to growing some of these African crops that I.
and you've got quite a few varieties. I think it's getting up to something like 100 varieties, or that's.
Yeah, something I don't really count them, but it is probably 100, maybe a bit more.
Having enough variety is something that you don't have to count them anymore. You just know that there's lots of variation and,
Yeah, it's not a competition, but it's really interesting to walk down the row and see a variety that's pretty much affected by a particular foliar disease, and then right there next to it, just a couple of feet away, one that's not affected at all. And then of course the Shenango strawberry apple tree is one that has the aroma of a strawberry, and then you have Arkansas black that's pretty much almost it's such a deep purple that it's really almost black, and some of the varieties you cut open and they're red inside, and there's just enormous number of tastes and qualities that are associated with apples. And by the way, you also get something really cool, which is that because all apple varieties are cloned, we can have, and I have in my orchard, the apple that was Thomas Jefferson's favorite apple, and also an apple that was in Charles Darwin's orchard. So you can You can go back in history and relive it.
There, after this program is broadcast, there may be a stream of people heading off to your farm and saying, please, please show us this one, show us that one, show us the tree that has five different varieties grafted onto the same stem. Because we'll,
yeah, I have one of those. It's just an amusement.
Carrie, it's been a wonderful ride talking with you today. The world is changing. We need to make some salutary changes as opposed to some of the disruptive changes that we've endorsed over the years and centuries. And it's quite clear that the work you're doing is central to that process of progression towards a better overall state of our relationship with planet Earth, especially around food and around our fellow humans. And I want to thank you for being on Food Conversation today. It's been a wonderful experience. Thank you.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it as well. And BC is near and dear to my heart. So I appreciate the conversation with you, and keep the faith.